My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Chapter 12 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 12. Locke's case seemed at last hopeless. The cruel ropes bit into his flesh and increased his agony, while the acrid fumes from the seething acid were slowly stupefying that keen brain of his. Backward and forward like a huge pendulum his body swayed, and in an agony of suspense he watched the fatal rope. With writhing body he swayed far out, and then he saw just one chance. The emissaries had thrown the rope over a beam which was far above Locke, and it seemed an impossibility for him to reach it. For one less resourceful, or with a physique less perfectly developed, even to try would have been useless. But there was one chance in a thousand, and he grasped it eagerly. Alternately contracting and relaxing his muscles, Locke succeeded in swinging himself in an ever-widening arc. Nearer he swung, back, and again nearer. Could he make it? Back again, and a terrific effort. He was gaining. There came to him the sound of running feet. In his fear and agony he could have shrieked, but from his parched throat there issued no sound. Friend or foe, for him it meant the same fate. One touch on that knob, and a torturing death by fire. With bursting muscles he redoubled his efforts. In a long sweep his body swayed out and up. Would he be in time? Those pattering feet, they were coming nearer and nearer. There were now but a few yards between them and that knob. A mighty swing, a monstrous heave, his fingers crooked, talon-like, and he touched the rafter, clutched, and missed. Downward and backward, his mind now reeling in black despair. He had tried and failed. This was the end. The sound of footsteps had ceased. Well he knew that someone was at the door. He tried to pray, and then he crashed against the rafter. Mechanically he grasped at it and clung. The door flew open, and there stood Eva. All the horrors of imminent death, even the pain of sorely tried muscles, were momentarily forgotten in his relief at seeing her safe and having saved himself. But not yet was he free. The emissaries had been thorough in their work, but it was not many moments before the last knot was loose and he dropped to the floor. Locke peered stealthily about. To all appearances everything was clear. He placed his arm about Eva, and they started to steal out. Well they knew that with such enemies, not for a moment would they dare relax their caution. For them, every angle and nook was a temporary haven. Slowly they drew away from the dread spot, and soon came to a more populous locality, where the lights of honest shops and peaceful homes gave them a sense of greater security, and brought a feeling of unreality to the horrors through which they had passed. A taxi driver hailed them, and in a short time they were rolling along the cliff drive and had arrived at Brent Rock. It was the following day that the old butler handed Locke a letter addressed to International Patents, Incorporated, from the Diving and Salvage Company. Locke was about to read it when Eva entered and they read it together. "We are reliably informed," read the letter, that the Underseas Corporation is trying to obtain possession of the self-liberating diving suit which you control in our interest. This must be prevented." Locke was immediately interested. At once it occurred to him that here was a patent which the company had suppressed which might prove of incalculable value. "This suit might be very valuable to the government," he exclaimed to Eva. "I am going to try it myself."
"Please don't," pleaded Eva. "It isn't worth it. It's not worth the risk."
Locke, however, realized that here was something of extreme importance, and as he visualized to Eva the helplessness of a deep-sea diver, his airline cut, struggling in vain to release himself and rise to the surface, he began to win her over. At the moment when Quentin and Eva were in the library, Zita was taking advantage and was ransacking Locke's laboratory, not with any definite purpose in mind, but searching in every nook for some clue which might tell her what he was about. The speed with which she worked was extraordinary. Yet before she moved an instrument, a retort, a book, its position was minutely studied, so that she could restore it to its former place without anyone suspecting that it had ever been moved. It was while she was thus occupied that her eye fell upon an instrument which aroused in her an excited interest. It was very like the headpiece used by operators of telephones, and she hastened to adjust it. In a moment it was as though she were in the library. She could hear Locke's earnest laugh, and in it Zita could detect an undercurrent of tenderness. Her lips compressed, and her eyes hardened as she listened. Locke was speaking about a letter, and it seemed to be something important. Zita was all ears. But Locke's next words, which she heard, were his decision to test the diving suit, and as she listened she became tense, for this information she knew was important. The continued note of tenderness in Locke's voice more infuriated Zita. She removed the headpiece of the dictagraph, slammed it back into the desk drawer from which she had taken it, and hurried out. In the library, Locke, having persuaded Eva, left her and went down into the graveyard of genius, where he touched the secret spring, and the massive door flew open. He entered the gloomy place and went at once to the shelf upon which lay the self-liberating diving suit. He took the suit down and examined its every detail minutely. As he did so, he became more and more enthusiastic, and he could find no fault with any of its features. "It's entirely practical," he exclaimed to himself. "I'm going to try it today." He closed the great door and remounted the stairs, carrying the suit with him. But had he noticed the fiery eyes that had watched him through the secret rock door of the cavern, he would not have been so eager to try the test he had in mind. By this time Eva had called her car, and together Locke and Eva drove to the nearby cove, where there was a little launch which he planned to use. Out into the river they sailed, Eva at the wheel, while Locke busied himself over the sputtering engine. Soon they arrived at a spot which was suitable for the test of the suit. Locke had brought along the full equipment, and, while Eva took charge of the air pump, Locke donned the diving suit. Soon all was ready, and Locke descended over the side, after carefully instructing Eva in each detail. Eva started pumping, while with her other hand she carefully paid out the air line and signal cord. But in their close attention to the task in hand, neither had noticed a low, knife-like launch that had followed them and that was now hovering a short distance off. Locke was now walking over the shell-strewn bottom, examining curious objects here and there. The tide was setting in strongly, and at times it was with difficulty that he kept his feet. He had become satisfied that this particular suit filled all the requirements of a first-class diving suit,
and he was about to try its special, self-liberating feature when his attention was arrested by a vague mass which seemingly moved against the current. This was so extraordinary that his first thought was of a shark. He stopped in his tracks and became motionless, for it is a well-known fact that these sea-tigers rarely see an object unless it is in motion. Still, the vague form slowly took on more distinctness as in its course it gradually drew nearer to him. It was then that Locke was almost overcome with surprise, for there, groping his way toward him, was a diver, like himself. What was this strange being doing there on the bottom of the sea? Whence had he come? Locke could not guess. For, like Eva, he had not noticed the other launch. It seemed impossible to him. Still, to him, apart from curiosity at the appearance of the other diver, the incident had no other interest. What had he to fear from any man at the bottom of a peaceful harbor? Locke moved nearer. The stranger allowed him to approach, stopped even, as though he were himself amazed at Locke's appearance, and Locke made gestures to reassure the man of his good intentions. Locke was quite close now, and through the glass gate in the other's helmet he could see his eyes. But in those eyes he could see no responding friendliness. There was a murderous hate instead. He tried to step back and place himself in a position for defense, but he was too late. For with a movement amazingly rapid for one underwater, the stranger leaped upon him, at the same time drawing a long knife. There, under the sea, commenced a battle royal. Locke was unarmed, and so from the start was at a disadvantage. The stranger seemed not so anxious to stab him as to come to close quarters, and before Locke could prevent him, he had done so. With his left hand he grabbed Locke's lines, while with the other, in which was the keen knife, he slashed murderously. Locke tried to break his grip, but the other was not to be denied. With one stroke he cut through both lines, pushing Locke backward and himself springing free at the same time. Immediately Locke's helmet filled with seawater, while the pressure became enormous. Locke tried to hold his breath, while his hand searched for the liberating knob. He gave it one twist. It worked perfectly. Locke's suit, including the helmet, simply opened and fell from him. Propelled as much by the pressure that the water exerted as by his own powerful strokes, Locke shot to the surface. The day was perfect and the bay was calm. For a few seconds Locke floated, drawing the air into his starving lungs. Then he raised himself and gazed about him. At first glance everything seemed the same except for the fact that, whereas before his own boat had been alone, there were now two. Then Locke heard an agonizing call for help from Eva. After he had gone over the side of their launch, Eva was naturally very intent upon keeping him plentiful supplied with air. He had been down some time before, glancing about, she had spied the other launch. But at the time she had thought little of it. For her, all thought of danger was centered on the man who was now risking his life many fathoms beneath her from pure motives of patriotism. It was only some minutes later, when she heard the grating of another boat against the side of her own, that she realized that she herself stood in danger. But even at that moment her thoughts were of Quentin, who now, for the first time, was wholly dependent on her efforts alone. She looked up fearfully, and what she saw fairly congealed the blood in her veins. Directing a murderous emissary to board Eva's launch, in the cockpit of the other boat stood the automaton. Not for an instant did Eva cease her efforts at the pump, but she shrieked with terror again and again. Now, to add to that terror, the pressure on the air pump suddenly ceased.
From the depths, myriads of bubbles of air arose. Knife in hand, the emissary leaped aboard and came toward her. Automatically, frantically, she still turned the useless pump, while with her free arm she tried to ward off the poised knife. Again her shriek for help echoed across the water, and this time her call was answered. Had she gone mad? The voice that answered her was the voice of the man she loved. Her brain reeled, and she fell at the feet of the murderous thug. Other cries, then shouts, were now heard, for some fisher folk were putting out offshore to discover what all the tumult was about. The automaton made a hasty gesture to the emissary, who sprang back from his victim and leaped to his own launch, where, with his assistance, there was barely time to haul aboard the chief thug who had been sent below to attack Locke. The launch cast off, and with ever-increasing speed headed down the river. Locke was the first to arrive and climb over the side of the boat. Dripping though he was, he took Eva in his arms and bathed her face, while by this time other craft arrived, and friendly hands did all they could to care for them both. It was some minutes before Eva was restored, and all headed again to the shore, eager to help Locke. As he assisted Eva to land, and they waited for a carriage, Locke hastily offered a boatman a liberal reward for the discovery of the precious diving suit, for it had been his intention to present the patent to the government. Meanwhile, some strange things had happened. Paul and his father had quarreled over money, over Deluxe Dora, over Paul's manner of life and his ill luck in winning Eva's affections. At the same time, Dora had become more insistent in her demands for money to meet her extravagances, and Paul conceived an idea of selling one of the patents to a rival company. Strange to say, it had been the self-liberating diving suit, and the rival company was the Underseas Company. All this took place some time after the disappearance of the automaton and his precious crew. Some hours later that evening, a telephone message came for Locke from the boatman that the diving suit had been recovered and was being held by him. Locke replied that he would be down in an hour. But during that hour, other strange things occurred. For no sooner had the boatman hung up his receiver than a pleasant voice hailed him, and he left his house to investigate. It was Paul Balcom. It was in a clever, insinuating, affable manner that Paul approached the real object of his visit. His appeal was cleverly worded, cleverly presented. The sole object was to awaken the poor boatman's cupidity. The sum mentioned, no less a sum than $5,000, would mean luxury to the poor man. And all for what? Simply to call up a stranger, a Mr. Locke, to tell him that the boatman demanded more money since he had telephoned before, that the cash was to be placed by him in an old packing-case from which a stationary engine had been removed that morning? It was just an exchange, that was all.
"Sure, I'll do that,"
the boatman told Paul, and Paul, smiling craftily, gave him his hand to seal the bargain. The boatman went back to his quarters and again called Brent Rock, making his new demands. Locke was tremendously indignant, but he wanted the suit quickly to prevent its falling into unscrupulous hands. He agreed and immediately started for the dock. The boatman turned from his telephone and, picking up the suit, regarded it curiously.
$5,000, he muttered. $5,000.
And he shook his head wonderingly. He was standing near an open window and was commencing to fold the suit preparatory to taking it to the end of the dock where lay the engine case, when, without the slightest warning, three emissaries of the automaton, who had appeared just a moment before on the dock, leaped through the window, and felled him to the floor. He struggled feebly, but it was no use, and a final blow left him unconscious. The emissaries next grabbed the diving suit and left hurriedly by the way they had come. But they had not completed what it was they sought to do. The old boatman was not as badly hurt as it seemed, and was able to drag himself across the floor with just strength enough to pull the telephone from the table and call Brent Rock. Then, as weakness again overcame him, he managed to blurt out a message to Eva, who answered.
"Don't let Mr. Rock come to the dock," he managed to gasp. "He'll be killed."
Then he collapsed and fainted. Eva tried frantically to get the boatman again on the wire, but it was useless. Quickly, a plan formed in her mind. If she could only intercept Locke before he reached the dock. She dashed out to the garage, realizing that it was almost hopeless, since Locke had been gone some time. Hoping against hope, she jumped into her speedster and swung out and down the road. The fact was that, even as she sped along toward the cove, Locke was passing the arched gate of the dock. He called at the boatman's little shack. Of course, there was no reply. To all appearances, it was deserted. Thinking to find him at the very end of the dock where he had been told to place the money, he proceeded to the engine case. He was slightly surprised at not finding the boatman there, but as that was no part of the agreement, it engaged his attention for only a moment. He started to withdraw the money from his pocket, groping at the same time to see if the diving suit was actually in the case. He was bending over, when suddenly there was a rush of men behind him, and a blackjack in the hands of one of the ruffians just missed his head. He fought, but their numbers were overwhelming. Like a pack of wolves, they pulled him down. Locke was quickly bound with ropes and forced into the engine case. The cover was put on, and they nailed it down solidly. To make it doubly sure, this time, the case was then lashed with ropes, and they were knotted. Next, the emissaries carried the case to a sloping landing stage, preparatory to casting it into the river. It was at this moment that Eva came running down the dock in wild search to intercept Locke. Wide-eyed, in the moonlight, she paused at what she saw. The emissaries had given the packing case its final shove. Scraping, it slid down the incline and toppled overboard. There was a great splash as it struck the water and immediately began to sink in the depths. The engine exhaust had evidently protruded from the case, as there was a hole in its side, slightly larger than a man's hand. To Eva's horror, though she had half expected it, she saw actually a hand thrust forth from this hole as if waving frantically. The box sank lower as it rapidly filled with water. Eva knew not what to do. Instinctively she knew that it was Locke. It was as though he had waved a last farewell. Only the hand now showed above the surface. Finally, that too disappeared beneath the waves. Despairingly, she turned to see if there was anything on the dock with which she might help Locke, and she saw the automaton himself advancing from the shore toward her. She turned. The emissaries on the other end of the dock cut off any chance in that direction. Without a moment's hesitation, Eva poised herself a moment on the edge of the dock and leaped far out into the blackness of the river. End of chapter 12. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 13 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 13. The box that held Locke a prisoner was now undoubtedly resting on the slimy bottom. Eva had totally disappeared. The automaton, convinced that at last he had rid himself of his victims, waved away the emissaries and departed. Except for the tiny lights of ships on the river and the staccato exhaust of a tugboat, the river flowed with nothing to remind one of the two tragedies of only a few seconds ago. As far as the eye could see, the surface of the water was unbroken. Then, suddenly, the scene changed. For from out of the water, as though hurled up by a catapult, shot a man's body. It was Locke. By what miracle had he escaped from the watery grave? From the time he was a small boy, the study of locks and bolts, of knots and straitjackets, of anything that could restrain or bind a man, had held a marvelous fascination for him. Until now he was recognized as one of the world's greatest experts on these subjects. The great lock concerns often sent for him to test new inventions, and invariably he could point to any flaw in the constructions of them that existed. As he came to manhood, his knowledge had grown apace until to many he seemed a veritable sorcerer. It was by a trick known only to himself that he had been able to extricate himself from his desperate plight at the river's bottom. True, his flesh was lacerated. True, he was on the verge of total collapse. But he lived. He made his way slowly toward the dock and was resting against one of the piles when he heard a faint cry. He strained his ears to locate the direction whence it came. Once again that feeble call floated across the water, and in it there sounded something vaguely familiar. He was more rested now, and he swam farther under the dock. Again came the cry. With a thrill now he recognized the voice.
"Ava!"
he called again and again.
"Here I am!"
came back the echo. With a powerful stroke he breasted the current, and in a moment he was supporting her half-fainting body. Precarious though their position was, Locke felt the thrill of her words. The effect was to spur him on to fresh efforts. Eva had become stronger now. For a few moments he swam, in order, if possible, to find some means by which they might escape from the water and reach the dock. They had no way of knowing but that the automaton and his emissaries might still be lurking above, ready to thrust them back into the water, or to reserve for them some even more terrible fate. But it was a risk that they realized must be taken, and at once. An attempt to swim to another dock could end only disastrously. Locke soon returned with the cheering news that he had discovered a ladder that came even to the surface of the water, a landing for small boats. More than that, he had mounted the ladder, and from a short survey he had seen no sign of their enemies. Carefully aiding Eva, Locke swam to this ladder, and soon they stood upon the dock, safe. With great caution they moved toward the street, and without harm, finally passed beneath the arched gates again and were in the city street. Eva went at once to her father's room. His condition was one of great weakness. The laughing madness had abated him so far that the poor victim was so weak that the spasms could not maintain a very violent form. Eva practiced all those little kindnesses which are known only to women, and tears were in her eyes as she stroked his poor gray head. How terrible was it that, after all they had attempted, all that they had suffered, they should still stand defeated in their aim to get the antidote that would cure her father's malady. However, the brave girl was not one to admit herself beaten, and even as she sat there she was planning new ways to discover who were her terrible adversaries and to bring defeat to them. At Brent Rock the next morning, an aged inventor named Winters arrived before Locke was downstairs and was shown into the library to wait. Locke soon descended from the laboratory and went into the room to meet him. but Winters was so agitated that at first he could hardly speak. It was some moments before he gained control.
"What can I do for you, sir?"
inquired Locke, although he knew the man must be one wronged by the patents company.
"One of my inventions was returned to me, when I protested once," the man replied, "but nothing has been done about two others."
"Please try to have a little further patience," pleaded Locke. "Everything is being done to assure justice to all."
"But, Mr. Locke," the man persisted, "I must insist on the return or the immediate marketing of the two inventions now in the possession of international patents, or I will—"
He paused, for Eva had entered and was overhearing what Winters was demanding.
"I am sure that as my father returned one of your inventions," she interrupted, "he would wish me to return the other two, and I shall do so at once. Mr. Locke, will you be so kind as to get them?"
Locke immediately left the room and descended to the graveyard of genius for the two models. In the laboratory above were Balcom and Zita, for she had told him of her discovery of the dictograph. Balcom had the headpiece firmly clamped over his head and was drinking in the purport of the conversation down in the library. Zita was almost beside herself with curiosity, as Balcom repeated only scraps of the conversation that went on below, but finally the real subject of the whole matter was repeated to her, and she was satisfied at last. A peculiar look came into her eyes. As for Balcom, one would have thought that a whole world's treasure had suddenly been placed within his grasp. Yet each was cautious not to betray too much to the other. Over the dictograph came the words spoken by Eva.
"Mr. Locke and I will come to your workshop at 8 this evening to complete the transaction."
Locke, in the meantime, had brought the two models into the library, and the inventor had almost danced with joy at seeing the children of his brain again. Sent down by Balcom, Zita had been ordered to spy on Eva and Locke. She had been nearly caught by Locke as he was returning from the graveyard of genius, but had slipped behind a pair of portières at the end of the hall, and had emerged only when Locke had entered the library. She had crept close to the door and was listening. She, too, now heard the inventor exact a promise from Eva and Locke not to fail to be at his workshop at 8 that night. Zita had but a second to glide backward from the door as the inventor came out into the hallway where she stood. He gazed at her in such a strange, fixed manner that an uncanny feeling came over her. Then he passed out just as Balcom came down the stairs.
"Why did that man look at me in such a strange manner?" she queried of Balcom.
A moment Balcom considered her, as though undecided to speak, then made up his mind.
"Because," he replied slowly, "he knows the secret of your birth, knows who you really are."
Zita had no further chance to question Balcom, for at this instant Eva and Locke, still carrying the inventions, were leaving the library. Locke turned down again toward the stairway leading to the graveyard of genius, while Eva, nodding pleasantly to Zita and Balcom, mounted the stairs leading to her father's room. Zita turned questioningly again to Balcom.
"Half of everything that girl possesses rightfully belongs to you," he whispered.
Zita apparently did not understand.
"What shall I do to obtain my rights?" she asked.
"Do as I say," returned Balcom, as he left quickly.
It was some hours later that in the dark corner of the graveyard of genius the huge rock slowly swung outward. There was a clanging and clanking of metal. Two fiery eyes gleamed through the aperture and out stalked the hideous monster, the automaton. With strange ominousness it went directly to the two models which Locke had returned, took them, turned and went back through the great gap in the wall from which it had come. Again, slowly, the huge rock swung back into place. Locke, with some sort of intuition, had deduced that young Paul Balcom, by his very absence, might have played a leading part in all the events in which both Eva and himself had been thwarted and almost killed. Accordingly, he determined to find and trail Paul. It was some time after the models had been stolen in his absence that, in a taxicab, Locke, having gone from place to place which he knew Paul frequented, at last caught sight of him leaving a dance hall of very ill repute. Paul was just stepping into a car which whisked him off rapidly, and Locke gave an order to his own driver to follow him. They wove in and out of various streets, and finally turned up the drive, where, after a few minutes, Paul's car came to a stop before a palatial apartment house, and Paul alighted. Looking up and down the drive, and seeing nothing to cause him suspicion, Paul entered the house. Locke carefully noted the address, then leaned back in his cab to await developments. Paul was taken to the third floor, and there was admitted to a gorgeous apartment.
"I thought you'd never get here," languidly greeted the feline Deluxe Dora.
She led him to a chaise lounge seductively, taking care, however, that he should see a pile of unpaid bills that lay upon a table near it. Paul was not entirely at his ease, and wasted no time in coming to the point.
"Look here, Dora," he began. "I know you can't run this shack on air. I got your note this morning. I've been busy, and I've got an idea. I've made up my mind to take a couple of those inventions the company owns and sell them. It means coin."
Dora's eyes gleamed avariciously.
"Be patient," Paul added, "and I'll have you swimming in gold."
At this juncture, three young fellows of the cabaret type, better known as lounge lizards, were admitted to the apartment. Paul cast a glance at Dora which clearly spelled jealousy and reproach. He knew the fellows. In fact, there were few denizens of the underworld whom he did not know. Concealing his vexation, he tried to greet them easily. The fellows returned the salutation hastily.
"Say, Balcom," hastened one of them, "someone is on your tail shadowing you."
Paul was startled and furious, but in this emergency it was Dora who thought out the plan of action.
"In a nightcab?"
she repeated, as the others told what they had seen outside.
"Listen to me, Paul. Go to the window and show yourself. Then leave the house. This fellow Locke will investigate, and we'll tend to the rest."
Paul moved to the window, opened it, and stepped out on a small balcony. Dora slipped to his side, and for a moment they stood there gazing apparently at the view of the river. Then they re-entered the apartment.
"Now go, Paul," said Dora. "Whoever this fellow is, we'll handle him."
Paul started to get his hat, then stopped and from his pocket drew out a small package.
"I was going to use this elsewhere," he said, "but it might come in handy to—"
Dora reached for the package, but Paul withdrew it hastily.
"Careful, Dora," he admonished. "There's a small gas bomb inside."
The five now conferred a bit, and it was agreed that this time the inquisitive Mr. Locke would surely trouble them no more.
"With Locke out of the way," promised Paul to Dora, "the road to our fortune is clear."
A moment later, Paul left the apartment, descended in the elevator, and jumped into a taxicab and was off. Locke, from his cab, had, of course, seen all this, had seen Paul and Dora on the balcony and the departure. But he knew nothing of the three men who had gone to the same apartment. He waited until Paul passed out of sight, then stepped out of his cab, making a careful calculation as to the exact location of the woman's apartment, for he had determined to find out about her. From the hall boy he learned that it was Deluxe Dora, of whom he knew, and it was only a matter of seconds when he was admitted. Dora swept over graciously toward him.
"Will you answer me one question?" he asked in answer to a query from her.
She nodded assent.
"How long have you known Mr. Balcom's son?"
"He is an old friend," she replied. "I'm expecting him to return at any moment. Won't you be seated? Please excuse me just a moment."
Before Locke could say a word, she had left the room. Left alone himself, Locke took in all the details of the room, and again his eye wandered to a Louis XIV desk. Feeling certain that this woman was without doubt connected in some way with the plots, he felt justified in opening the desk to obtain evidence. He tiptoed over to it and tried to open it. It stuck at first, but after one or two silent, well-directed blows which he so well knew how to administer, the sliding panel stood unlocked. He glanced around. There was no one to be seen. He moved back the panel. There was a flash and a tiny puff of smoke. Locke coughed once, clutched at his throat, and lay gasping on the floor. Immediately the three men rushed out, carrying ropes and holding handkerchiefs to their nostrils. One ran to the window and threw it wide open, admitting gusts of air to clear away the fumes. The others began to bind Locke as Deluxe Dora appeared in the doorway and calmly directed operations. On the roof of the apartment, several moments later in the just-gathering dusk, five figures might have been seen. Three men and a woman were conferring, while at their feet was a man, tightly bound and unconscious. In the background was a huge water tank with a ladder leading to its brim. Suddenly the conspirators straightened up. They had come to a decision. The three men lifted the unconscious figure and bore it up the ladder. The tank was empty. One of the men jumped down into it, while the others lowered their victim after him. Then they passed down ropes. There were two spouts at the bottom of the tank through which water was pumped. Also there were pipes running upward. To these pipes they tied Locke. Then the men climbed out and, as their last fiendish act, turned the water on. With a sneer, Dora turned and led the way downstairs again.
"They'll find his body when they have to clean the tank again," she exclaimed.
At Brent Rock, during the absence of Locke, Eva had donned her street clothes, since it was nearing the hour of 8 when she and Locke were due to be at the inventor's workshop to render the restitution. She went downstairs and asked the butler about Locke, but the man replied that Mr. Locke had not yet returned. Eva was very uneasy by this time, and, thinking to save time, was about to go down to the Graveyard of Genius to get the models of the two inventions, when Zita came down the hall, carrying a fair-sized package, which she tried hard to conceal. Eva greeted her and continued down to the cellar, as Zita, with a sort of grim smile, left the house. Eva came to the great door, pushed the secret spring, and in a moment was inside the gloomy place. She went directly to the spot where the two inventions had been kept. They were gone. Alarmed, she rushed upstairs. Still, Locke did not return, nor did any word come from him. It was now very near to 8. Eva decided to go, for surely Locke would be there. When Zita arrived at the inventor's, in her hands was still the mysterious package. She carried it gingerly, then raised it to her ear. From within it there came a faint ticking sound. What was inside?
She looked at her wristwatch. It was still some minutes before 8. She knocked at the inventor's door. The inventor at once admitted her. It was a neat little workshop in which every detail had been thought out with care. The home, one might say, of a methodical workman. The inventor manifested some surprise at seeing Zita, but politely asked her to enter and offered her a chair. Zita declined and plainly showed her nervousness.
"Will you please give this package to Mr. Locke and Miss Brent when they come at 8?" she asked.
Winters agreed and accepted the package, looking quizzically at her as he did so, just as he had earlier in the day. Zita, unable to control her curiosity, burst out with the question uppermost on her mind.
"Why do you look at me in such a strange manner?" she queried.
The inventor merely turned his gaze away and shrugged.
"Mr. Balcom tells me you know the secret of my birth," pressed Zita.
The inventor looked up quickly.
"Who did Mr. Balcom say you were?" he asked.
"He told me that I was Brent's daughter," replied Zita, keenly watching the aged face.
"Balcom lied to you," hastened the inventor.
Already there was a ponderous tread on the stairs, but Winters did not seem to notice it.
"You are not Brent's daughter," he pursued more slowly.
The door opened swiftly, and an emissary stood framed there, a knife poised in his hand. Behind him stood the automaton.
"You are..."
At that instant the inventor caught sight of the intruders. With a look of horror in his eyes, he threw out his hands to protect himself, but he was too late. The knife whizzed through the air, and a second later pierced his throat. He fell to the floor, dead. At the moment when the emissary, followed by the automaton, entered, Zita, watching her chance, managed to escape from the room, stumbled, and almost half fell down the stairs. Already, in the huge water tank that stood on the roof of the apartment of Dora, Locke had revived as he felt the water and had found himself already half submerged, with the water rapidly pouring in. At first he could not grasp his terrible predicament, but before long the full horror of it burst on him, and he struggled madly to free himself. Since his body was stretched at full length, it was impossible to use the ordinary tricks of which he was master. His arms were bound, and he well knew that to release one of them constituted his sole chance of escape. He contracted his muscles, and, inch by inch, he worked his right arm free. By this time the water had risen until he was fairly beneath its surface. Could he last long enough to free himself? He worked frantically. Finally, with his lungs almost bursting, he managed to free the other arm, then the rope that bound his neck. To release his feet was, to him, child's play, and he stood up. But the water had risen almost to the top of the tank before he was able to grasp its brim and draw himself out. Once on the roof, there was only one thought in his mind. It was nearing 8 o'clock, and if Eva kept the appointment at the inventor's, he knew his adversaries well enough to be sure that they would take advantage of his absence. He dashed down the stairs and out of the building. Dora and her evil band could wait. He must reach the inventor's shop. As the seconds sped, so increased his premonition that all would not be well there. It was at the moment that Zita came flying downstairs that Locke burst into the hallway to the inventor's. Zita saw him. Above, she knew, was the terrible automaton and his bloodthirsty emissary. More horrible yet, she had her fears of the package that had been given her by Balcom to deliver.
"You must not go up there,"
she cried impulsively, flinging her arms about Locke's neck. Locke tried to remove her arms as he questioned her. but Zita either would not or could not tell more. Instead, she merely clung to him. Thus it was that Eva, determined at keeping her appointment with the inventor at all costs, entered the hallway at just this unpropitious moment. To her it looked as if Locke and Zita were very familiar. Could it be that Quentin was such a cad? She could not deny the evidence of her eyes. Indignantly she brushed past them and rushed up the stairs. Locke called after her, but she refused to heed him. He flung off the arms of Zita and dashed after her. But Eva was too quick for him. She opened the door to the inventor's and went in, slamming it behind her. The lock snapped. In an instant, Eva saw what she had fled into. There was the automaton, near him the emissary with the knife, and on the floor their victim in a pool of blood. She shrieked and tried to escape, but the lock had snapped. Besides, the emissary, now directed by the monster, blocked her retreat. Outside, Locke pounded on the door, but could not open it. It was of stout oak, and would take some moments to break down. The emissary circled in one direction. Eva turned, and there was the automaton advancing on her from the other side of the room. On the table, the clockwork bomb, delivered by Zita, whether with full knowledge or not, ticked out the last few seconds before its timing at precisely 8. End of Chapter 13. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 14 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 14. Eva flattened herself against the door at her back. She could feel and hear Locke pounding on the other side. She thought that she would die of sheer terror. The automaton raised his mighty fist, and Eva instinctively ducked under the monster's arm. There was an inner room. Could she reach it in time? Would the door be unlocked? At most, she could only try. The emissary tried to catch her, but she proved too quick for him. She reached the door. It opened, and she flew into the room, slamming and bolting it behind her. Now she could hear the thunderous blows of the automaton raining against the door. One huge fist of the monster crashed through the panel. Eva crouched down in a far corner and closed her eyes. At that instant the time bomb exploded, and the house was rocked to its foundations. Everything was demolished. One entire side of the house was blown out. The door leading to the workshop, which, a moment before, Locke had been vainly striving to open, crashed full upon him and felled him, half-stunned, to the floor. The force of the explosion had dazed Eva. As for the automaton and the emissary, they had both been blown through a gaping aperture in the wall to land in the garden beneath. Only Zita, in the lower hallway, was totally untouched by the catastrophe. Locke, dazed, crawled from under the door and made his way into the demolished room in search of Eva, a cold fear gripping his heart. How could any living thing have lived after such an occurrence? But in another instant he saw her as she half swooned and staggered into the room.
"Quentin!"
she gasped. He caught her in his arms. But the next moment she remembered what she had witnessed in the hallway below, and she drew herself away from him.
"Go to the girl you really love," she scorned.
"The girl I really love?" repeated Locke. Then there ran through his mind what had happened as though it had been ages ago. He protested and tried to explain. but protestations and explanations only made matters worse, as usual. Had she not with her own eyes seen Locke in Zita's arms?
"Eva," he persisted manlike, "I swear that she was only trying to save my life. I cannot help it if she—"
Locke saw that his defense was only making an innocent matter worse, and checked himself. His mind recalled that someone had once said that a jealous woman believes a man guilty until he proves himself innocent. When he has proved himself innocent, she merely still suspects. Eva's manner was very constrained. At that moment a policeman, followed by Zita, entered, and Zita, running up to Locke, cried anxiously,
"You're not hurt, are you?"
Locke answered in an annoyed negative. The policeman now questioned them very closely and examined the dead inventor's body. Then he entered their names and addresses in his notebook. Next, the officer led the entire group down to the garden. There the horribly injured emissary was trying miserably to crawl away. The automaton had totally disappeared. Eva immediately ordered that the injured man be taken to Brent Rock in her car. Then she turned sharply to Zita.
"How did you come to be here?"
she demanded. Zita was startled and confused. It lasted only a minute. Then, her mind made up, she replied defiantly,
"I came here to discover the secret of my birth. I have been told that I am Mr. Brent's daughter."
Eva was stricken dumb with astonishment at this startling claim, but Locke laughed outright.
"What nonsense!" he scoffed. "Eva, don't listen to it."
Zita glared at him, and with a haughty nod to Eva, swept out of the garden. Eva was still frightfully indignant with Locke, and insisted on going home alone. However, they arrived at Brent Rock at about the same time. The emissary had been placed on a lounge in the library, and a doctor was called. The case was quite hopeless, and they merely hoped to obtain a confession before he passed away. When Eva arrived, she went directly to her father's room, but as he was receiving every attention from a trained nurse, and she could do nothing further to aid him, she returned to the library. Locke, too, after changing his clothes, still wet from the water tank on the top of the apartment, also went to the library. At his entrance, the doctor glanced at him in a manner to indicate that there was no hope of saving the man's life. Locke went over to examine him. He was struck by the sly rascality of the professional criminal, but he thought little of it at the time. He tried to question the emissary, but except for a labored breathing, could extract no response. There were voices in the hallway. For a moment the dying man showed some signs of returning consciousness. A crafty look came over his face. What was he contemplating? The door opened, and Balcom and his son Paul entered. Balcom walked jauntily, but with a suavity of manner that was always his. Paul looked at his best, except for the fact that he carried his left arm in a silken sling. Balcom greeted them all, and at his voice the dying man actually showed a sort of agitation. A strong shudder seemed to pass through his body. Then, like a spring suddenly uncoiled, he sat up. He was fully conscious now, and strove to rise to his feet. It was a tremendous effort, but he succeeded, and stood confronting Balcom, while the ominous light of hatred that gleamed from his eyes as they encountered those of Balcom made even that well-poised man recoil and shudder. With the muscles of his face working convulsively, the dying thug tried to speak. All those standing in the library realized that it was to accuse, to denounce. However, the effort proved too great, and with a groan that was ghastly, the man fell backward on the couch.
dead. Murdering brute that he had been, still to Eva and Locke he now represented nothing but a stricken human being, with a human soul, blackened and warped. But Balcom and Paul seemed to show unmistakable signs of joy and relief. It was so evident, Locke thought, that he turned to them.
"Your coming seemed to have an unfortunate effect," he hinted. "The man seemed to know one of you, at least."
"Nothing of the kind," retorted Balcom, nettled. Locke turned to Paul and regarded his injured arm questioningly. Paul, however, never lost his accustomed aplomb.
"I was hurt in an automobile accident," he explained, though with what seemed to be a trifle of nervousness.
Locke turned to the doctor. He was rubbing his hands and smiling with great unction, an action very unbecoming, to say the least, in a medical man who had just lost a patient. Taken all in all, Locke felt he could now sense the web of conspiracy tightening around him. The cards were still in the hands of his enemies. He determined to incur any risk, to leave no stone unturned in order to bring the criminal to justice, whoever he might be. One thing encouraged him. The event seemed to have mollified Eva. He made an almost imperceptible signal to Eva, who left the room to dress for the street. Meanwhile, Locke left the library and went to a private telephone that connected the garage to the house. He ordered the chauffeur to have a fast runabout ready for instant call. Then, at the other telephone, he notified the coroner's office of the death of the emissary. By this time, Balcom, Paul, and the doctor came out of the library, the doctor in high good humor, for had he not received a huge fee? He left in his car. Balcom and Paul, however, were slower in going, and paced the hallway in earnest conversation. Once they came to a dead halt close to the stairway leading down to the graveyard of genius. They listened intently. Evidently they came to a decision on something, for they left the house very hurriedly. Immediately Locke called for the runabout. Eva came running downstairs, and in a moment they took up the trail of the Balcom car. It seemed as if they traveled for miles, and Locke was commencing to think that it was merely a wild goose chase, when Balcom's car came to a halt in one of the lower quarters of the city, before a house that was apparently tenantless. To avoid discovery, Locke backed his car around a corner, got out, and watched their movements from a safe distance. He saw Balcom Sr. alight, but Paul did not leave the car. Locke was in some quandary what to do. To attempt to enter the house without Paul seeing him and raising the alarm would, he realized, be impossible. Therefore he waited for nearly a half an hour before his patience was rewarded by seeing Balcom come out of the house, jump into the car, and drive off hurriedly with Paul. Locke walked to the house and looked closely over the exterior. It was little different from others in the same street. Then he walked thoughtfully back to Eva, and they argued pro and con about the advisability of attempting to enter. Locke insisted on entering alone, but Eva would not hear of it. Therefore it was decided that they would go in together. When Balcom had alighted from his car half an hour before, he had merely stood for a moment in front of the door of the house when, mysteriously, the door had opened. There was no one in sight, but he was so familiar with the house that it might have been his own. He descended a flight of stairs and stood before another door, where the same door-opening process was repeated. Balcom entered a darkened room and for a moment seemed quite alone. Then, from out of the shadows, with a little half-run, half-lope, a strange figure of man came toward him. He was in reality large of frame, but stooped and bent with age. an old frock-coat was wrapped about him. But the most remarkable things about the man were a pair of weirdly fascinating eyes, with a mad glint in them, and an enormous full beard, snow-white, that fell almost to the waist. At times the man talked rationally, in fact with the forcefulness of a great savant. Then, abruptly, he would leave off, and the rest of his conversation was that of a babbling child. He was seldom at rest, scampering here and there, not unlike a bird-dog on a fresh scent, seeking, always seeking. What? Balcom grasped his arm in order to arrest his attention.
"Dr. Q," he addressed him, "you can have the revenge you have sought so long. Have you prepared everything?"
The old man chuckled and wagged his head in senile fashion. Balcom grabbed both his shoulders so that the old man was facing him and shook him slightly.
"Your enemies are here," he emphasized. "Have you prepared for their reception?"
And then the haze beclouding the old man's brain seemed to pass away, and his next moments were lucid.
"Ah, it's you, Balcom. You were just saying—"
Balcom explained that Locke and Eva had tracked him, and on his departure would undoubtedly enter to investigate the place. Dr. Q, for such was his odd name, understood now, and an evil grimace distorted his wrinkled face.
"Let them come," he growled. "I am prepared. Why, I have even improved certain features of the Chair of Death."
He led Balcom into an inner room where many electric bulbs were dimly glowing. At their entrance, two brutal-looking men straightened up from their task and saluted Balcom with great deference. Then they resumed their tasks as electricians.
"Want to see your work, sir?"
one of the pair asked. Stepping around a partition that separated the knife switch from the room in which stood the electric chair, Balcom watched. The chair was of practically the same construction as the chairs used in prisons for the supreme penalty, with electrodes to connect at the head, arms, and legs of the man to be electrocuted.
"Stand back, sir," called one of the men as he shot the switch home.
Instantly a snapping sound was heard as the current surged through, and the crackling sound, such as the now familiar wireless makes as the long sparks leap from pole to pole. It was force. A satisfied look came into Balcom's eyes, and he warmly congratulated the mad inventor, who followed him to the door and watched him as he mounted the stairs to depart with his son. Soon after the departure, Dr. Q went to a strange-looking instrument that seemed to have many of the characteristics of the periscope. He pulled a lever, a panel opened, and immediately the space directly in front of his street door was revealed to him. He stood there, watching intently, much as a spider watches for a fly. Soon Locke and Eva showed in the panel above. He next pressed a button and saw the two enter. Then he went to a huge divan on the other side of the room and whipped off a covering that was concealing some gigantic thing beneath. It was the automaton, prostrate, at full length, without motion. At least it seemed so. The madman glanced around and then glided into an inner room from the larger one. He was just in time, for a moment later Locke and Eva entered. They, too, glanced around fearfully. They saw the dread form of the automaton, and although it did not move, Locke would have admitted he was ready to beat a retreat. It was uncanny, weird. In the dim light the monster seemed to assume gigantic proportions. But he lay so still that their jangling nerves became quieted. They even approached him, Locke with automatic in hand in case the iron terror were shamming. but there was no sign of life, or whatever it was that animated this thing. Locke, handing his gun to Eva, determined to investigate further. He went to the inner door and listened, but he could hear no sound. He turned the knob and entered. He was amazed at what he saw. But as there was apparently no living thing about, he took courage and entered farther. He took note of the switches, saw the deadly chair, and was about to test the apparatus to see if it could be possible that a practical electric chair existed in the heart of a peaceful city, when he heard Eva shriek in heart-rending terror. He rushed madly back to where he had left her. But as he passed through the door, someone dealt him a blow on the head, and as though pole-axed, he dropped to the floor. After Locke had left her to go into the inner room, Eva's fears revived, and she wished to follow him. But she was ashamed to have him think her a coward. She forced herself to remain rooted to the spot. Her eyes had followed Locke through the doorway, and her ears were strained to hear the faintest sound from the other room. In her anxiety about Locke's safety, she even forgot the automaton, and in turning the better to watch the doorway, she drew nearer to the divan upon which the monster lay. It was this action that had brought her into peril. Slowly one of the monster's arms commenced to move, and before Eva could spring away, she was enfolded in his deadly embrace. It was that made her shriek madly, wildly, in utter terror. Then she saw Locke running through the door to her, saw him struck from behind, and she fainted. The automaton, evidently thinking Eva dead, let her limp body slip to the floor. For a moment it towered over her, as though contemplating whether to trample on her or not. At this juncture an emissary distracted its attention, and the terror left her lying there without further injury. The automaton now assumed command of Locke's electrocution. Under its direction, the emissaries picked up Locke's body and placed it in the electric chair. They slit his trousers so that the deadly electrodes might form a better contact with his flesh. His sleeves were rolled back for the same reason. Next, the headpiece was firmly adjusted. Now all the straps were tightly clinched. The automaton waved his arm. A man stepped to the switch. End of chapter 14. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 15 of The Master Mystery. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Master Mystery by John W. Gray and Arthur B. Reeve. Chapter 15. There was a moan from the front room. Eva was recovering from her faint. The automaton indicated to the emissary at the switch to do nothing until he had found out what was going on. Locke had, meanwhile, recovered consciousness and realized his awful position. Here was a situation which, on its face, seemed unescapable. Yet Locke would not give in. Straining every effort, he tried to extricate himself before the deadly current could sever the thread of life. Seconds seemed ages. Still he tried. With a mighty effort he strained every muscle of his gigantic chest, and the very straps that held him groaned from the force of his muscular exertion. Even now the death man was at the switch, and it was barely a question of seconds or heartbeats between him and death. With a quick twist of his giant shoulder, he threw his whole weight against the chest strap, and it parted. Lurching forward, he freed his head and neck from the cruel straps, which snapped and parted. The death man paused for a fraction of a second to see what caused the commotion in the chair. To that pause Locke owed his life. With a final supreme effort he threw himself on the floor just as the knife switch swung into position and the wicked blue flame of death leaped across the head electrodes. Once freed, he catapulted himself across the room and with a vicious uppercut sent the emissary sprawling unconscious to the floor. Without a thought of himself, he rushed into the next room where Eva now stood in panic, glued to the spot, in fear of the Frankenstein monster that would crush her in its grasp. With murderous mien, the thing crossed the room slowly until only the table stood between her and destruction. Like a wild animal, Locke hurled himself into the room and with a master stroke of quick wit flung the heavy oaken table over at the monster. Then he seized Eva, and before the monster could turn in its tracks, half-dragged, half-carried her from the room. In the hall, further difficulty confronted Locke, for the place was well guarded. Several henchmen darted forth from dark corners of the murky place and would have intercepted him. As the first approached, Locke, with a quick jiu-jitsu thrust, hurled him for a fall that would have broken the back of a less hardy man. The next one was just turning the top of the stairs, and Locke, quick to take advantage of the situation, adopted the only means of escape. He seized the man bodily about the waist, and, lifting him over his head, threw him upon his other oncoming foe. The result was that the two were flung down the stairs.
"Run!"
he cried to Eva in a voice that was a command. Without waiting, he picked her up and carried her over the sprawling mass of legs and arms to safety below. Once outside, he felt a little embarrassed at having the beautiful girl in his arms, and he half-murmured an apology as he placed her feet gently on the ground. Life at Brent Rock was far from monotonous. Like a great game of checkers, the various members of the establishment were being moved about, guided by some strange hand, it seemed. Now one, then another seemed to gain the advantage, and as each strove for control of the vast fortune, the battle of wits surged back and forth. Balcom was playing a game, it was plain. But to what extent? Sometimes it seemed as though Zita was his aide and would stop at nothing to succeed. Again it was that Zita played the game alone, still fostering her secret but hopeless love for Locke. Again it seemed as if Paul were playing the game, either alone or with someone else. Just now it was apparent that Balcom and Zita, for their own ends, whatever might be the identity of the automaton, planned a coup for themselves. During one of Locke's absences, Zita had secured access to his laboratory, and while looking around had discovered the dictograph hidden in the desk drawer. Often Balcom and Zita, either together or alone, had taken advantage of the discovery. It was at a time when both were using the mechanical eavesdropper on Locke and Eva in the library that Locke suddenly decided to return to the laboratory without saying anything about it. Zita's quick ear heard him down the hall.
"Quick!" she warned. "Someone is coming!"
She sprang toward the closet door, which stood ajar, and in an instant Balcom was with her. The two were concealed in the closet as the laboratory door opened and Locke entered. Locke walked to his tables of test tubes and picked up one containing mercury. What prompted this action he did not know. Perhaps it was his fascination for the elusive metal. Perhaps it was some subconscious feeling. At any rate, he held it aloft and gazed at it in the light. As he did so, a strange thing happened. Reflected in its surface on the glass, yet distorted like a convex mirror, he could see the door of the closet open, just a crack, and the evil faces of Balcom and Zita peer out. He did not move, nor did he in any way betray what he saw, but nonchalantly set the tube of precious metal down and pretended to seek something from the table. He turned slowly and retraced his steps to the library below, where he entered, holding his fingers to his lips in warning to Eva not to speak. He walked quickly over to a writing desk, took a pencil, and began to write.
"Balcom and Zita are listening on the dictagraph. Pretend to quarrel with me."
Eva read in amazement as he wrote. Quickly she comprehended. Then they walked silently until they were almost under the chandelier which held the transmitter of the dictagraph.
"I have something I want to say to you, Mr. Locke," began Eva, with a wink and a smile at him. "And it grieves me to say it."
"What is it?"
asked Locke with distinct anxiety, winking back.
"I am afraid I shall have to dispense with your services," continued Eva, as she reached out her hand and gave Locke's a little squeeze.
Upstairs, Balcom and Zita listened intently, their heads close together, so that each could catch every word. Balcom was nodding with satisfaction. Each looked at the other as though they could hardly believe their ears.
"But I have tried to serve and protect you," protested Locke, as his face wreathed in smiles at Eva, who was carrying the deception off perfectly.
Then he added, plaintively,
"I am sorry that I have failed."
"Your protection has led me into danger," returned Eva, in her best voice to denote anger. "And your seeming interest is out of place. And besides, Mr. Locke, Paul Balcom does not like your being here. You know he is the man I am to marry."
As she said this, Eva looked roguishly at him. Locke's face clouded a little, although he knew it was only in a joke.
"But Miss Brent," he continued to protest, "I had hoped—"
"Not another word, Mr. Locke," interrupted Eva,
as she edged very close to him and gazed into his eyes.
"Please leave this house at once. I hate you."
And, not suiting the action to the word, she reached out and gave his hand a squeeze that told more than words what her true thoughts in the matter were. Locke leaned over and was on the point of kissing her when she held up her hand and pointed to the receiver above in the chandelier as if it really had eyes as well as ears. He looked up and was forced to check a laugh lest it be heard by the listeners above. In the laboratory, Balcom had heard enough. He turned to Zita and with a hurried command told her to go downstairs.
"Keep an eye on him and tell me where he goes," was the parting instruction of Balcom
as the two separated on the stairs at the very time that Paul blustered in the front door.
"Morning, Governor," nodded
Paul as he gave his hat to the butler.
"A very good morning, Paul,"
emphasized Balcom quite unctuously as he went on to tell his son of the supposed quarrel between Eva and Locke which he had overheard. A light of triumph came into Paul's eyes. Eva's happiness, even her life, meant nothing to him. She was merely a means to his own evil ends, and he now felt sure that he held her in his grasp. Besides, in so far as such a selfish nature can care for another human being, Paul cared for Deluxe Dora. There was a satisfaction for him in her tigerish, unscrupulous nature that a good woman could never inspire. And now, as he eagerly listened to his father, he visualized new motor cars, a yacht, rivers of champagne, a life of mad gaiety with his favorite pals, men and women. Locke, in the library, was laughing quietly with Eva over the success of the ruse. But there was, notwithstanding, an undercurrent of seriousness running through their thoughts. For although they had scored against their adversaries in misleading them as to their intentions, both realized that Balcom was a tremendously clever man, astute and wise beyond the average in the ways of the world, and that the slightest lack of caution, the smallest flaw in the acting of the parts they had elected to play would inevitably lose for them the advantage they had gained. They went into the most minute details of the plans they had formulated, and they realized that in order to keep the wool pulled over Balcom's and Paul's eyes, it was necessary that they separate, at least apparently, for a few days. Locke gave out that he was to seek evidence in the lower quarters of the city, while Eva was to play the game at home. It was to Eva that the more difficult role fell. Locke bade her an affectionate farewell, and left by a door opposite to the one leading to the main hallway, where the voices of Paul and his father were now audible. Eva opened the hallway door and greeted Paul, feigning delight and chiding him for his long absence, which had not been even a day, intimating that there must be some woman in whom he was interested. She made a pretty show of jealousy. Paul, wearing his vanity on his sleeve, was delighted, and his eyes shone with satisfaction. He took a step forward and attempted to take Eva in his arms, but she evaded him playfully while he pursued her. Finally, she could bear no more. The game revolted her. She made the excuse that she must attend her father and ran upstairs. So a day or two passed, days which were sheer torture to Eva. Paul called every day, bringing her little gifts, and it must be acknowledged that he showed exquisite taste. They took long walks together. On horseback they cantered all over the country. Friends called, and it was at such times that Eva found her only relief from Paul's attentions. Many a rubber of bridge she played just to escape being alone with him. End of chapter 15. Recording by Roger Moline.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.